Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live. This Monday edition, really, of course, a lot happening over the weekend to talk about today, including the aftermath of the London attack. And now the media is battling it out. Not surprising, but pretty disappointing, I think, in a lot of ways. Also, a warning from the mayor of Los Angeles that is worth noting. It's the anniversary of the Six-Day War. We've got some details about that. And also, the New York Times is getting rid of their internal watchdog. Doesn't seem like a good idea. That and more, this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm. Live link here at thetrumpet.com as well. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, there's some room at kpcgfm. Also, you can email us comments at kpcg.fm. Monday edition of Trumpet Radio Live, getting back into the swing of things. Busy weekend. Many people, of course, check the headlines Saturday night and saw the terror attack over there in London on the London Bridge. Only, what, about not even 2 weeks away from the last one, which was that Manchester attack. And I believe the artist there, Ariana Grande, she was doing a concert like this weekend to sort of commemorate, or I don't know what it was for, raise money or something, for the past attack. And now there's another attack. So they've been coming rapid fire, and it's always interesting when you see these attacks happen. I kind of go to like three or four different websites. Some are conservative, some are liberal. I kind of like to see how they play it. At first, it's the headline of what's happening, and then not much longer after that, then they start to go into their, especially the liberal sites, their narrative of it, which is anti-President Trump. What did he have to do with it? And that's what they're talking about today.
Did you hear? I think there was an MSNBC host who questioned if possibly Mr. Trump was trying to incite another terror attack for political gain. So a conspiracy theory to the extreme there, and really implying a lot of motive that they could never know he has.
You know, you try not to get too upset about certain things, but I do find this very upsetting, just the way that some of the media is going after these events. It's like they're not even really talking about the actual event. They're just talking about tweets and what somebody said, and they're not even covering what's actually happening there. We're sort of ignoring it. You know, if you notice, you really don't see the pictures of it. It was gruesome, but they don't really show you that.
Yeah, it is kind of puzzling that most of the analysts this morning was from Trump's criticism of the mayor of London, saying they took his remarks out of context, and that was the big controversy this morning. But what I found puzzling was Prime Minister Theresa May's remarks on the terrorism. She had 4 points on how to end terrorism, and they all had to do with internet protection and that sort of thing. And I'm sure that's part of it, but it just kind of puzzled me. That's just the weakest response imaginable to a terrorist attack. And especially in a country like Great Britain and London, where they have, of all Western countries, they have the most experience with terrorism, with all the years with the IRA battling out there. They have a lot of history to look back on. They have a lot of success fighting terrorism. And then they completely ignore it and say stuff about internet. It just, to me, it's just befuddling how the British people can have any faith in that kind of leadership.
Well, and they do reference the fact that, you know, London could withstand Nazi bombing, and so this terror attack that won't thwart them. There's a major difference there. They were actually fighting back against the Nazis, right?
Exactly.
That would be the difference.
Yeah.
Nobody's doing anything right now, and so they're attacking President Trump for coming out and having a little bit of at least a strongly worded statement, which I don't even think was that strongly worded. And they're saying, "Oh, he's an alarmist. He's terrified, but oh, over there in Britain, they're taking it. They're tough. They're not doing anything.
Why not just have a few security measures put in place? There was a guest on Judge Jeanine Pirro's show on Fox News Saturday night, and he was talking about how they could easily put up some of those like bollard fences in between the lanes on the bridge and where the passengers are walking on the sidewalk. They could also put armed security guards on either end of the bridge at those choke points. I mean, there are so many different ways where you could put multiple levels of security around any of these events. And he even brought out the one in Manchester. Why is a 30,000 seat arena not just completely surrounded by all kinds of security to where a guy like that couldn't even get close? There are a lot of ways where you could change it. He also brought out how you might need to even change laws so that you could get warrants and break into the homes of people who might be suspected of terrorism. But short of that, there are also a lot of practical steps you could take. Instead of, you know, trying to call people alarmists, why not just change a couple small things and see a big cutback in the amount of terrorism?
Yeah, I always think about when the media is going back and forth and pointing fingers. I think about the victims and their families. Do they think it's alarmist? Do they think, oh, well, let's just carry on? Well, they can't carry on because their family has been killed or part of their family. They're not just going to go on like it's normal Monday. And so it's really puzzling. I also saw a headline yesterday where I think they were trying to insinuate something. The main headline was, the officers used 50 bullets to kill three terrorists. Well, I don't care how many bullets they used. Yeah. They're out there hacking people to death with knives. What difference does it make? What are they insinuating there? I'm not sure. I read the article and they didn't really get into anything, but the headline was so big and bold. I'm not sure why that even matters. What does that have to do with anything? But it seemed like it was trying to go somewhere, and I'm not really sure where it was going.
That does seem to be a big concern of the media. After a lot of issues with terrorism, like what do they do to the body? They care more about the terrorist dead body and how that's treated than they do about the fact that those people before they were killed were actually murdering a lot of other people. That's the thing to focus on. Instead of calling names, the media could get practical. They could show some common sense and maybe offer a couple of solutions based on what these security experts are saying. Instead, like you brought out, they're just trying to attack the president, and he's not even part of that country.
It must be just befuddling. We mentioned this before after, I think, the last attack, and it's been mentioned plenty of times. It must be befuddling for terrorists to see the response, where they're not even really even talking about the source of it. We're fighting with each other. And the terrorists are the ones that perpetrated the horrible act. And the media sits there and attacks the leadership in the country and just goes back and forth on that, and that's all the talk. You'd almost be sitting there as a terrorist thinking, wow, I mean, we thought they'd at least push back a little bit, but they're not, apparently, except for perusing the internet, apparently.
Right. Well, it is interesting because a lot of people, a lot of influential intellectuals say that terrorists want us to become a police state or to take away our freedoms, or if we show any sign of fear, they're winning. To me, that's a wrong way to go about it. We do have to change our society to defeat terror, even if it's temporary. Because otherwise, we're just going to allow innocent people to become easy targets. But what is interesting is the way the media is acting is allowing the terrorists to win. By becoming more divided under attack, that's how enemies get the upper hand. The only way to defeat terrorism is if we're united. And I've been reading Isaiah Berlin's essay. He talked about Winston Churchill's leadership during World War II. And he's some very strong statements just saying that Churchill was able to rally the people because he told them the truth. He told them to be fearless and that they might have to die for their country. But he was doing something about it. And he wasn't telling them to accept this as normal. We have to change. We have to be willing to sacrifice to get rid of it so we can go back to normal. And you don't see that today. The British people especially, they don't want to sacrifice in any more wars. The war in Iraq showed that. They're war weary. They're not really willing to go to fight another war over anything. And so as a prime minister, you have this problem to where the right thing is to go fight a war, but your people won't. And if you do try to, they'll vote you out and put someone else in. And it's just this really destructive cycle. And so all this is more, I think, a reflection of the lack of will in the people. to have any kind of resolve to do anything about it. And there were reports of British people fighting the terrorists, throwing chairs at them, different things like trying to stop the attackers themselves before the police showed up, and that's all well and good. But it does just show a decaying society to where we can't even sum up the courage to have a strongly worded statement, let alone any kind of force that these kind of people deserve to be met with.
This there's a little bit of a write-up here about the media. It's from the New York Times. There's a couple of interesting points. The title of their story is After London Attack, Trump, again, at the center of partisan media combat. And they say a CNN host called President Trump a, quote, man baby, and then another very, very derogative term that we can't say, and actually used it on the air. They say used a very profane term.
Later, there was also a contributor to CNN who tweeted something obscene
right.
about him as well.
Yeah, but they apologized later, so that was fine.
Yeah. that's all it takes.
Seems to go. A guest on Fox and Friends proposed that Muslims in the UK should be placed in internment camps, and then they got into a fight about that. A Breitbart news writer argued on Twitter that there would be no deadly attacks in the UK if Muslims didn't live there, and then a lot of people got angry about that. And then they say Mr. Trump himself, and this is what's partly interesting as well, they say in his first public comment about the attack in London on Saturday night, disseminated unconfirmed information, which, by the way, turned out to be absolutely true, from an unofficial source, the Drudge Report. New York Times says that the Drudge Report is an unofficial source.
Hmm.
Well, the Drudge Report just pulls stories from other sites. They don't typically write anything themselves. And doesn't mean they're always going to be accurate, but they were right. Does it matter? Does it matter when something is tweeted and it's not confirmed yet? But it happened. Is that the big issue in the middle of a knife attack on the London Bridge? Is that the big issue?
Well, as far as my experience with social media concerned, very few things on social media are confirmed and true. Most of it is just nonsense or opinion. But there is a lot of care in when those events happen to try not to spread panic by retweeting crazy things. But in the case of President Trump, he went to a news site. Every other news site, CNN, MSNBC, whatever you want to, all the other ones that are picking on him, tweeted the exact same thing as him. And their sources were the same as Drudge Report sources. So it's just a way to criticize him when on the surface level, no one should be going to social media for confirmed news. It's just a way to get information. It's just a... when people are being killed, it's just a weird thing to spend your time thinking about.
Well, and you can see there, the liberal media doesn't like Drudge, obviously. That's no secret, right? And so they're making their concerted effort now to undermine it. Why don't they like him, or why don't they like some of these other sources? Because they're putting out a narrative that's different. And sometimes is closer to the truth of the matter. Not always, but a lot of times I think it is, actually. And so they're so concerned about somebody proving them wrong and stopping their ideas. What's going on with that? I mean, isn't the media's job to report, or are they trying to rule? I mean, that's the question.
Yeah, and getting back to even just the outrage when someone says something about there'd be no terrorist attacks in Britain if Muslims didn't live there. The thing is, when a statement like that is made, the media, they don't try to prove it wrong. They just react with emotion, and they scream at the guy until he becomes quiet, and they call names. You have to refute that with facts, or a statement like that is allowed to stand, and yet they just can't handle it. It goes against their ideology of supporting Muslims no matter what type of attack comes up, and it's kind of hard to justify after a while.
It is to the point where you do wonder what would have to happen for people to get unified and all say, let's just come together and put aside our partisan differences and have a common cause that we could believe in. You do have to wonder what it would take.
Yeah, I did see a headline last week, too, where they tried to link Matt Drudge with Jared Kushner and how Kushner's talking to the Russians. He's in collusion with them and so much Drudge. And so Drudge is becoming a mouthpiece for Vladimir Putin. So I saw that headline last week, which is ridiculous because he doesn't even write his own stories. They're just links to right. whatever. It doesn't make any sense. But
he's the missing link.
Yeah.
In the story.
But yeah, it's just ridiculous how they're trying to link all these people together, and there's no smoking gun and there's no smoke. There's nothing there for them to find. And what is interesting is if the media has always been very divided, except in wartime, that's when they get together. But it shouldn't take war to be united. In fact, we are at war, just that people don't want to recognize that fact. And as a quote we read, I think, last week from Bing West on the war in Iraq, that the media had a big role to play in actually almost stopping the war in its tracks and preventing America from actually having victory when we were actually were fighting a war. So if the media had that much power in wartime, when we're people are supposed to be united, then peacetime, like you said, trying to rule people's ideas. In peacetime, they're not going to, there's no reason for them to stop what they're doing and try to get more influence to where they rule what the politicians say, unless they have a fear of being just sacrificed on the headlines.
It's funny, speaking of Vladimir Putin there in Russia, he was interviewed by Megyn Kelly. It was her, I guess, NBC debut. And I didn't see it, read a little bit about it. And, you know, he didn't answer any of her questions the way that she may have wanted. But I always think that's a little bit funny when journalists who do take themselves very seriously interview, say, Vladimir Putin, who's a leader of another nation. And he's not beholden to the U.S. media in any way. And they kind of try to get him with questions, and he just laughs at them. And what does he care? He's the leader of Russia. He doesn't care what an NBC journalist thinks or anybody else. I just think, what are they thinking? Like, they're going to pin him down and he's going to leave in shame? He doesn't care. I don't know what they're going for there. Ratings, obviously, but I don't think they're going to get any truth out of it.
That does expose the delusions of grandeur that the media has, to think that they have that much influence and power that they can effectively shame a rival world leader into doing their bidding. Yeah. It's not going to happen. And also, you mentioned Jared Kushner, Abraham. It's the media has gone one by one through pretty much every member of the cabinet. Obviously, they started with the president first, but then they went to his wife, then they went to his daughter, then they went to Steve Bannon, then they went to Jeff Sessions, and they just keep going on and on and on, 15 minutes at a time. All the media just swarms around one guy in the cabinet, Ben Carson. They attack viciously, and then they move on to the next one, and they just hope eventually that they can undermine some of these people.
And then a lot of times, further reports just reference the earlier report of something maybe happening, but nothing actually happened. So it's like they're making this sort of, or they haven't proved it anyway. I don't know, but they haven't found anything. So, but it just kind of builds on itself to where I think people, if they're not really paying much attention, you can kind of forget and think that, oh, yeah, I heard something about that guy in Russia. That must be a thing. But really, they never got to any facts on it.
Yeah, if you notice, the only people they don't pick on are the generals, the five generals in Trump's cabinet, because except for McMaster, they've been going after him a little bit. But they never pick on James Mattis, the former Marine general, because several times when the media has tried to get in there, he just tells them to leave or be quiet. And he doesn't put up with it. And they just, there's no negative thing about him. They're actually praising him as the lone star in Trump's cabinet. But he's reflective of many very positive cabinet appointees in Trump's administration. But they won't go after him because they can't touch him because he has such a great record and he hasn't done anything wrong in their eyes, I guess.
Maybe they're afraid that he'll keep them up at night, like he said he does to all the terrorists.
Yeah, there was an interview with CNN, I think, and one of the guys asked him, like, is there anything that keeps you up at night? And he said, no, I keep other people up at night.
It's a good answer. There's an interesting headline today from The Hill, which is worth thinking about, I think. This is from the Los Angeles Mirror. It says, immigration arrests could cause a tinderbox. Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti, in a recent radio interview, said he is concerned that increased immigration and customs enforcement, or ICE as they're known, raids under the Trump administration could cause already high tensions in his city to boil over. He said, if something goes wrong, I fear a tinderbox out there. You know where people will suddenly say no and try to defend. You know, keep that person from being taken. He told that to Latino USA, so you know who's listening to that. He says, that's a very dangerous situation. That's dangerous for those officers. That's dangerous for those agents, and we're going to have to respond. So that does seem like sort of a fear-mongering a little bit there. But he's probably right in a sense that it could be a bad situation. But just the fact that he's speaking to the Latino community there, that just seems like not a wise thing to get into. I think you would be better off to say, look, we're going to uphold the law in the city, and that's the way that we run the city, and we're behind our officers 100%. And I think that would be the message to get out, as opposed to, hey, it could go bad. It almost seems like a prognostication of some kind.
Well, if there were an element of respect for the police, which that has really deteriorated lately, people wouldn't even dare try to resist them coming in and trying to deport somebody. The federal police in that case, they would not even let it cross their minds. But now the way the climate is, people are starting to think that they can get away with resisting because the police are afraid to act.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation there. That's the Los Angeles mayor, so that's what he was talking about. One other story today, it's not a good one either. This is from Orlando. Orlando shooting leaves multiple people dead. That happened Monday morning. Five people, including the shooter, are dead after a shooting at an Orlando, Florida business headquarters, according to CNN. Police say there is no connection to terrorism. It appears to be work-related. But that's the time we live in, right? As soon as you see anything happen, the first thought is it a terrorist act? More details coming out about that, I'm sure, but Monday in America these days.
Yeah, well, I think it's shows that even if there isn't a planned terrorist attack, there's just the problem of domestic violence, gun crimes, knife crimes, vehicle crimes, any number of things that's going wrong in America. And if there are people out there willing to use a gun, then when there is terrorist attacks or chaos, it just makes it all the more likely to happen if those elements of society are already willing to do it now. So it is should make us think, and as we referenced last week with America, the 141st most
peaceful
country in the world.
Yeah,
I mean, there's more proof of it that if we can't have our own citizens respect each other and not kill each other, then the terrorists are winning without even attacking us.
Bad deal there. Here's one that's much better. This is a better story. And it's it shows the bravery, I think the bravery, of the Canadian citizens from Fox News. You got to look this picture up online. It's phenomenal. Tornado won't stop Canadian man from mowing his lawn. And you can find this picture online. There's this fella, and he's wearing a orange shirt and some blue shorts. Looks pretty average out there mowing his lawn. And behind him is a tornado. And it's a ways back, but still, it is a massive tornado. It's the kind of thing that would make you run and hide. Not this guy. A photograph captured a brave Canadian man continuing to mow his lawn in Alberta while a tornado swirled behind him on Friday. He said, I was keeping an eye on it. And he just kept mowing his lawn. Well, and it's funny because when I looked at it, my first thought was, did they Photoshop this? Because, like, who would do that? But all reports are that that's an actual photo. And the guy said, well, it was a little further back than what it looks like. But you have to look at the photo for yourself. He had a list of things to do that day, and he was going to do them, even though there was a tornado behind him. So pretty amazing.
Yeah, I read a story with that, and I guess his wife is the one who took the picture. And the only reason she took the picture was to send her mother a picture of the tornado. She wasn't intending to do anything, but just her husband was driving by in the lawnmower.
pushing it.
And then it's like, well, people are like, well, forget the tornado. What is he doing?
Yeah, I was trying to think. And that was Friday. Was there a hockey game on that day?
There was.
Friday?
Friday night.
Was it Saturday night?
No, I think it was Friday.
Friday, okay.
Wasn't it?
I'm not sure, but I was wondering, I could, like, hey, look, I got to mow this lawn. I got a hockey game to watch.
Actually, maybe it was Saturday. Yeah.
But maybe he was prepping. He was getting ready, but
yeah.
But pretty amazing. Yeah, I can't imagine doing that just because even if for some reason you didn't feel threatened, you think you'd at least turn around and give it a look-see. It was a pretty fascinating thing, and he's just mowing the lawn. He's going the different direction. So anyway, if you get a chance, check it out. It's all over the news today, and it's a pretty neat story. So that's one brave guy. or dumb. I'm not sure which way it goes.
Definitely steadfast and undeterred from his tasks.
That, you know, if this guy could start a lawn mowing service and use that for his advertisement.
I don't back down
from any lawn or anything. I'll mow your lawn, rain, shine, tornado. Because I saw the headline for it and it said, you know, man ignores the weather to mow his lawn or whatever. And I thought, wow, this looks interesting. And I was assuming it was raining or something. You know, and then there's this huge tornado right behind him. So good for him. That's a Hall of Fame photo there. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com as well. The Key of David program is coming up in a little bit. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Make sure you listen for that. And Adjust the Best Literature as well. Headlines at thetrumpet.com today. Check them out. Crossroads for Catholicism. High-level infighting, Islamic aggression, global secularization. How will the Vatican respond to these grave crises? History gives us a clue. That's by Richard Palmer. You can find that at thetrumpet.com. Related to that, the Holy Roman Empire in prophecy. Grant, before we get into your story, we are going to diverge from the world of world news and talk about the National Basketball Association. Abraham, you have a Twitter poll. There's been a lot of talk about who's the greatest player ever because LeBron James has been playing very well lately.
Right.
Well, for the last, I don't know, decade or better. And so there's this debate, you know, who's the greatest player of all time? It's always a hard question because nobody saw everybody play and you don't see them play against each other. And they used to have to wear the canvas shoes. That makes it harder.
Right.
So we did a Twitter poll of the greatest player of all time in people's opinion. We gave them a few options. What options do we give them and what is the what are the results?
So there are four options and these are just names are generally thrown out there for the best players. LeBron James, Michael Jordan, Bill Russell, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Those are the four options, and this is how they stacked. In last place was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Oh, come on.
With 0%.
No.
Tied for last place was Bill Russell with 0%.
Nobody
well.
Knows. See, just nobody knows.
Yeah, no one voted for them at all. I did have one person say they think Wilt Chamberlain was the best.
Wilt, so, he could be in there, sure. Yeah, he could be in there for sure. Yeah.
Well, those first two options were once considered pretty much unanimously the greatest of all time before Michael Jordan in their time frame pretty much. So maybe the trend is the latest great player becomes the greatest of all time.
I think so because Russell won 11 championships. I think 8 in a row at a point or something, but he won 11. He didn't score a ton, but defensively he was so good. And then Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, he lost one game in high school and one game in college. And then he won 6 NBA championships and he was the MVP of the league 6 times. He's the all-time leading points scorer in NBA history. And people are like,
I don't really
that's
care.
That's pretty solid. He's at least in the conversation, but people forget about him because, he played years ago.
Yeah, I think this is just reflective of the generation who voted. Yeah. It's people my age, like who... Maybe we've seen Michael Jordan highlights and seen LeBron James play or people who watch Michael Jordan play. And so,
and we didn't even throw in like Magic or Larry Bird or, I mean, there's so many guys you could throw in, but anyway, yeah. So the big debate with the moderners are LeBron versus Jordan. What do they say?
Yeah. And this is pretty overwhelming, kind of surprised me. Michael Jordan won with 94%.
Yeah.
LeBron James at 6%. I voted for Vince Carter, but he wasn't on.
Because he's from the Raptors.
Yeah, I just like watching him play.
He could jump out of the gym, as they say. Yeah, it's always a debate. You never know. And could there be one greatest? Probably not. They all do something a little bit different. But, you know, it's kind of interesting because the media was really talking about this LeBron versus Jordan thing before the finals. And I think now the conversation is anybody like watching the NBA anymore with the super teams? Because it's not competitive yet. Now, maybe it will be in the final. I hope it is. But all year, people were complaining. The games aren't competitive. And then the NBA basically said, well, just wait. The finals will be competitive. They haven't been competitive so far. And people are getting, I think, a little frustrated because you want to see a good game. You don't want to see it lopsided. And I feel like LeBron has played very well. But what are you going to do when you're going up against this four-headed monster it's hard to beat him?
Yeah, it is a tough situation for him right now. And it also does it does bear some significance that I'm sure Michael Jordan never faced a team as good as these Golden State Warriors, who are now 14-0 in the playoffs. The playoffs, where it's win or you're killed off, basically. And they are 14-0 in these games that are supposedly supposed to be the toughest of the entire season. 14-0. It's never even come close to happening before. I don't think anyone had even gone 12-0 before this year in the playoffs. And so that team is just historically fantastic. They haven't even won a game yet, or a championship yet, and yet they're probably the greatest team ever.
They can score in bunches. They're 2 minutes away from blowing you out, and they have three guys that can shoot from anywhere. And it's always hard. We always get caught in the moment, I guess, as far as greatness and that type of thing. But they are a tremendous team. It's hard. You'd have to, in order to beat them, you'd really have to have three of the best shooters in the NBA have off nights, and you typically aren't going to have that. They're going to make, you know, a few buckets, and what the announcers always say, and they're right, they're like, it wasn't bad defense, but the guy just shot it from, you know, what are you supposed to do? And especially like when they run, like, say, Durant and Curry, like, they're screening for each other, and you're not sure who's going to go where. You got to cover everywhere, because they can go out to half court and shoot it and make it, you know, or they can cut to the basket, so it's tough.
I actually don't have as much of a problem watching it as I used to, just because I've been careful about my attitude and my bias, trying to keep those things in check, because I don't like the Warriors. But if you just forget about the history with the Thunder, then it's a little bit easier to kind of enjoy something that you might never see again. Four All-Stars on the same team. You know, you can easily dispute how that team came together, but the fact that they're as remarkable as they are, it's hard to deny that.
Yeah, they're playing really good. As some commentator said, even during yesterday's game, and I think everybody in OKC has had this thought, why didn't you play quite that hard when you were in OKC?
It's a very strong question.
Because he did. Durant can always score, but he's played well defensively. And that's actually last year when he was with OKC and we won the first couple of games against Golden State, I thought the difference was his defense. Mm-hmm. He was blocking guys at the rim, and I thought, wow, hey. And then it just didn't hold up. So it's interesting. I've been watching some of the after-game press conferences, and reporters will ask questions of different players on both sides. And it's funny because they'll ask a question. The players don't really want to answer it, so it's just kind of this waste of time. But they'll ask a question, and then whether it's the player or the coach that's answering will answer with sort of a threatening tone, like, what do you mean by that? And then the reporter backs down, because I do have to try to be friends with these players, but I would love it for to be a bunch of guys like us that we don't care, we're not getting paid by them, so, because what I would love to do, this is a question I want to ask, I would love to do this, because last year during the season and during the playoffs, Green and Durant were texting each other while they're playing each other.
Right.
Oh, come play for us, or whatever they said. And those guys are clearly pretty good friends. You can tell just by the way they hang out. And I would love to ask them after a game and say, so are you guys texting LeBron during the finals? Do you want him to join your team next year? Of course, they'd be so mad at you. There'd be smoke coming out of their ears. Yeah, but wow. Hey, that's a legitimate question, I think.
That would be just a fantastic thing to watch. That is the issue with that whole thing, was that there was a lot of collusion there. Yeah. Rivals trying to make it easier for themselves by getting together. And really, the pressure got to Kevin Durant last year, and that's why he couldn't really finish off that team like he should have been able to, up 3-1, best of 7. Yeah. So he should have been able to win a fourth game in 3 tries, couldn't do it. And that's why he's in pretty much an ideal situation now. All those players are, because 2 or 3 of them can play poorly, and they can still win by 20 points. Yep. That's something that you've never seen before. LeBron James has all the pressure on him. Everyone's going to blame him exclusively if his team loses. But who do you really blame if the Warriors lose somehow?
Yeah, somebody was asking me, a younger person, getting my insight from all my years of basketball watching. They asked, I forget now what the question was. It was a great one, too. I was all ready to talk about it. And then,
was it about this era compared to the last
one? No, it wasn't that. It was, it sort of was. Yeah, the question was basically about, like, why are players leaving and joining these super teams? You know, what can you do to prevent it? I said, well, I don't know what you can do to prevent it. They are offering more money to stay with your own team, but the players don't need the money. They got tons of money. But I said, you know, years ago, it used to be more of a pride thing. Like, I don't want to join the guy. I want to beat the guy. The guy beat me last year. I want to get better, and I want to beat him with my team. That used to sort of be the feeling. But now it seems like, we're all buddies. Let's all play together and beat everybody else. And I don't know. it takes away from, I think, some of the competition in the league. And I'd like to see the best players kind of have their own teams and meet up and see who the better guy is.
Well,
better team is.
A big way to prevent super teams is to prevent the salary cap from going up $30 million between one season and the next. That's what happened that even made the Warriors have anywhere close to the money to sign someone like Kevin Durant. That was an anti-small market change in the salary cap that obviously hurt the Thunder big time. And then the commissioner even laments it happening. You're the one in charge of the league. You could have easily prevented it from happening.
You know, I'm sure the Warriors listen to our program, so I'm gonna put a bug in their ear. What about, you know, okay, Durant and Curry, you know, they're great and their team. Come on, Clay, you're not getting enough shots. Why don't you join the Thunder? Clay Thompson, come and play with Westbrook, deadly shooter outside, good defender. And then Clay could show, he could prove he doesn't need those other guys. He's better than those guys. I'll put the bug in his ear.
You know what's really strange is he's the one who single-handedly dismantled the Thunder last year with that unbelievable barrage of three-pointers in Game 6 of the Western Conference Finals. Just single-handedly won that game when no one else could do anything on that team.
Yep.
And then, and it's funny also because his younger brother plays minor league baseball in Oklahoma City. And so in a city where probably everyone hates his brother, he's actually playing professional baseball.
Yeah.
And so I always wonder how he feels about that. But at the same time, yeah, Klay Thompson is not getting enough credit right now. Maybe he could pull the ultimate anti-Durant spiteful move, because I feel like Durant's move was spiteful, and I think Klay Thompson could make just as spiteful of a move in the opposite direction.
The guy's getting 10 shots a game. But he's scored over 60 points in a game. He scored over 30 in a quarter.
Yeah.
He needs more touches.
It's true.
That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying. You can come on over to the Thunder. We'll trade you somebody. Kyle Singler or somebody. Straight up. No offense, Kyle. Grant, you've got to write up for us. This story is not surprising, but it's just not good news either. It's from the Free Beacon. New York Times internal watchdog position has been eliminated. They've been sent to the doghouse. The watchdog went to the doghouse. They don't feel like they need somebody watching their reporting, huh?
I don't know who looked at the New York Times and said, you know what we need is more bias right now, because they have totally exposed themselves for being anti-Trump, anti-really conservative in any way. A lot of that's disguised by them putting those types of pieces in their opinion pages. But still, when your opinion pages are anti-communist radical left or anti-conservative communist radical left, it's a little bit difficult to disguise that you have a liberal bias anymore. They've had this watchdog position since 2003 because they had some sort of a plagiarism scandal with one of their former reporters. So 14 years they've had this position, and now of all times they decide to get rid of it.
We were joking before we came on the air, that would be a really interesting job, wouldn't it? You walk into a room full of journalists that all have the same leaning, and you say, you know what, I think there's a little bias here. I could see not lasting long in that position.
Right. You know, I don't think Mr. Trump is literally Hitler. Get out of here. We do not agree with that.
Right. Yeah, and that conversation could have occurred.
Well, what's interesting is when Melanie Phillips was here, she talked about her time in The Guardian, and she just questioned something they wrote about the Lebanon war between Israel and Hezbollah. And she wasn't siding with one side. She was saying, oh, well, are we going to write something about this? Because we're covering this one social issue a little too much, and it's a war after all. And so after that, she wasn't implying a bias or anything. She was asking a simple question. They started calling her, well, it's your war, and those are your people.
Yeah.
And so they turned on her, and all of a sudden she said in that boardroom she felt like she was suddenly singled out and she was never able to get back in. Just because she wanted to talk about a war with that Israel was involved in. Nothing. So I mean that was back in the 80s or early 90s, somewhere in there. So if that was that bias back then in like the upper echelons of a major news organization, what is it today? I mean, that must be so supercharged that you can't even, there has to be unquestioned loyalty to whatever the editor wants.
Yeah, and the intimidation would be really high, because you would know. You would know what the pressure is there. So you're not free to write any other angle than what they want. Because even if you look at, I forget which paper it is, it might be the Washington Times. They sent out their email brief or whatever.
Washington Post.
Washington
right.
Post. And you look at the headlines today, and it's like, you know, how many ways can we make President Trump look bad in relation to the terror attack? I mean, that's what every single story was that, and it was the same basic story. They just would maybe take a little different angle on it, but pretty much it's the same story. That's the entire post for the most, but there was no other counterpoint or no other like, well, we see it maybe a little differently. I didn't see one on that. So, so long to the days of free journalism, really. I mean, unless you go to some other source, but those places are being shut down, so, or intimidated, or, you know, like Drudge pushed aside as, unconfirmed reports, that type of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. With that situation with Melanie Phillips, it was really shocking, like you mentioned, because just because she happened to be Jewish, somehow, even though she was living in Britain, she had more loyalties to the Jewish state. That's really what they were implying. And yet they don't imply the same thing with other people living within their borders, that they might have loyalties that lie in the Middle East and not back with their home country. It is interesting that there is quite a huge double standard there, but that is really just the direction that a lot of these publications and other news outlets have gone, where they just will viciously attack one side and turn a blind eye to the other side. The Washington Post actually already got rid of their watchdog position 4 years ago, and so it is kind of a trend recently where they are starting to cater more to certain readers. And the comment section reflects that. For the most part, on most of their stories, it's about 90-95%, you know, very far left type comments. So they are catering to those types of subscribers, and they're getting a ton more subscribers as well. It's actually working as a business model for them, because people who don't like Mr. Trump are turning out in droves, and they're turning over a lot of their money to really confirm what they already believed by reading some of these biased sources.
And I looking over this article about the New York Times getting rid of this internal watchdog position, where are they going now? They're going more to social media, they said?
It's a strange type of explanation they gave. They said that they're trying to turn to their followers on social media and their readers across the internet to hold them accountable.
So the people that agree with everything we say, we want them to hold us accountable.
Exactly.
We're going to tell the parrot something and see if the parrot says something different back to us.
Right.
I have an article coming out that will that's fact-checking one of their articles on the one we talked about on the Korean War.
Yeah.
So let's see if they – I'm not sure how much they'll like that.
Well, you know what's so amazing about that is didn't all of these major media outlets just criticize the President Trump for – tweeting something and using social media from what they claim is an unconfirmed source, even though it was pretty well confirmed. But now in the same breath, they're saying, oh, we'll just look at social media to hold us accountable. But I thought you didn't trust social media, but now you do.
Right.
Which one is it?
The amount of just lack of self-awareness is just shocking, if that even makes sense, the amount of lack of self-awareness. They really do not seem to realize that they are doing exactly what they criticize other people for doing. Yeah, there might be a few people who will speak out against what you're saying online, but if you look at the comment section, the vast majority are going to be in agreement with them, which will then give them reason to say that they're reporting the truth.
Yeah, it's like the comment section, really, no matter which way you slice it, it's like throwing meat into a water with piranhas in there. If you have one comment that doesn't agree with everybody else, the attack comes from every direction.
Oh, yeah.
They just eat them up. Pac-Man. So that's a really interesting thing. That's an echo chamber. They're using an echo chamber to verify their pre-built narratives.
They don't seem to realize how ridiculous it is that they're stuck in that echo chamber. They obviously have contempt for anyone who disagrees with them, anyone particularly not in a coastal city, not a wealthy person. They are obviously anti-middle America in a pretty big way. And even their advertisements have gone on and attacked the president. They had one that said, the truth is alternative facts are lies. And then they had a picture of the president's counselor, Kellyanne Conway, there. So they were making fun of that quote she had about alternative facts. Clearly a partisan advertisement in their paper. They can't claim to be the gold standard of journalism anymore.
Yeah, it was interesting because they were so sure that President Trump wouldn't win the election, predicting the greatest, you know, landslide of all time. Or they were pretty, a lot of them were pretty outspoken about how he was going to lose. And then it turned out they were wrong, and many Americans didn't feel that way. And so that was the question we were wondering about. Well, what's the media going to do now? Are they going to kind of come to their senses? Or, no, they doubled down on, tripled down, if you can do that, on their direction. And they're going to just keep pushing ahead. And this is just another sign of it. The New York Times internal watchdog position eliminated. Thanks, but no thanks.
They actually said their goal was to cut back on a lot of editors and add more reporters. So you talk about a position where it's probably the least accountable of any position in the world, being a journalist. You could quote unnamed sources all day, and no one can really pin you on it. It's impossible to find who the unnamed sources are because, of course, they have to protect those unnamed sources.
Sure.
Now they don't even have editors or watchdogs to keep them in line.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see a job posting for that. You know, you're a good fiction writer. what are the qualifications? Do you agree with us? Yes, because some of the things you read, they're not even written well necessarily. If it was really good fiction, you could say, well, maybe they're good writers, but I don't know. It's strange times indeed. That's from the Free Beacon, New York Times internal watchdog position eliminated. One other quick note before we get into some of this history about the Six-Day War. Big story today is the Qatar Rift. I've heard that in the country pronounced so many different ways. Qatar, Qatar, Q-A-T-A-R. You know what we're talking about. It's that Middle Eastern nation. The other ones, when I say guitar, it sounds like guitar. But I've heard some people say Qatar. I'm not sure what the exact pronunciation is, but you know what I mean. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt have cut diplomatic ties with them. They say it's one of the worst diplomatic crises to hit the Gulf Arab states in decades. The three Gulf countries and Egypt have accused Qatar, we'll call it, of supporting terrorism and destabilizing the region. Qatar, which shares its only land border with Saudi Arabia, has rejected the accusations, calling them unjustified and baseless. Yemen and the Maldives also cut ties with Qatar. The Qatar citizens have been told they have 14 days to leave Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the UAE, while those countries also ban their own citizens from entering Qatar. So we'll see what happens there. They're going after each other. Some infighting, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think it represents them reacting to President Trump and taking some kind of action against terrorism. So I think it is kind of positive, although every nation in that region do have terrorists in them. In Yemen, they're fighting a war right now against the Houthis, which are a terrorist group. So, I mean, it's a very difficult situation to assess there. With Qatar,
we're in a battle here. It's a new Twitter poll. How do you say it?
That's right. And I'll say Qatar or Qatar.
Yeah. Which one is it?
Yeah. But they, that one nation, though, they've had a lot of problems. They've said one thing and then done the other. A lot of misleading comments, a lot of backstabbing on their neighbors and on the U.S. policy. So I'm not too surprised that this happened. But it does reflect a pretty big problem in how Iran's fracturing the Gulf states. And if they can get them to all turn against each other, they won't be able to all unite and fight against Iran.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to watch. In the time we have left, Abraham, you want to talk a little bit about the Six-Day War. 50 years on, Israeli-Palestinian divide is wider than ever. I don't think that's debatable.
Yeah, this is from France 24, but it's been in other news sources too, just talking about the 50-year anniversary of the Six-Day War. And just to give a little background, the Six-Day War happened in 1967, and it's when Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Iraq, they all had plans to launch a strike against Israel, to launch an attack. And Israel had good intelligence. And so what they did is they launched a preemptive strike called Operation Focus, which would have happened yesterday. in which Israel destroyed in about 8 hours over 400 planes of the enemy. They focus on Egypt first because it was the biggest power. Back then, Egypt was the powerhouse of the Arab world. Then they went to Iraq and other places and destroyed their air power because you can't use tanks if your enemy has air superiority, because then a missile can easily destroy a tank. And so once Israel had air superiority, they were able to launch your other forces and fight back on multiple fronts. And it's in this, the reason the Six-Day War is so important is because it created the modern borders of Israel. It's in this war that Israel conquered the Sinai, the West Bank, which is the middle part of Israel, East Jerusalem, and the Golan, most of the Golan Heights. So in these, all those areas are very important religiously or strategically for Israel. And so this has kind of been the controversy since, is should Israel give up or go to the pre-1967 borders to allow the Palestinians to have their own state and what? So it was this moment 50 years ago that made really the modern state of Israel viable, defensible, and has really helped them all a lot stave off other attacks since from many, many other terrorist groups.
Yeah, it's always interesting when there is that question of whether they should go back to the borders before then. And I was thinking, no. it was war, and they didn't start it, and they won. So that's the way it goes. I mean, if you want to do that, are we going to go back to every nation in this world and be like, well, long time ago, the borders were different, so you could do that, I guess, but then that would change things. I don't think most people would want
to
do that.
Well, yeah, is America going to give Canada back to France and Florida back to Spain? Is that going to happen?
Some people would love that, yeah.
Are we going to confine ourselves to the far east coast of the country again and
give
all the land
Canada
back to the Indians? Exactly. Yeah, that's just, it just, everything would change so much, and you'd have an impossible time getting back to the origins of where everyone came from. But the thing is, no other nation is actually asked to do what they're asking Israel to do.
Right.
Well, and to Geneva, there are certain international laws governing these types of issues. And in every single way, Israel is fully legally vindicated in keeping their borders. There's no, they didn't do anything illegal. And if this was to be overturned, that means a lot of other countries would have problems. I think what's interesting is people are willing to focus a lot of time on this, but not talk about the Ukraine or Georgia, where Russia expanded their borders with no provocation. And so, but what's interesting is not only the strategic side, but it's, I think what this article does a good job of showing is that if for the peace process to work, you have to change the people. It's not just about what the governments think, what the intellectuals in America think in Europe. It's with the people, because they're the ones who actually have to live with it. And based off of, they have some polls here that have been said other places, but many people think there isn't a good chance for peace. 78% of Israelis think there's no chance of a peace agreement. Another poll found 60% of Palestinians believe the two-state solution is no longer viable. So pretty large percentages of both people think it's peace is impossible the way that it's trying to be done. And that's because the people feel it's impossible to bring those two populations together because, well, number one, the Palestinians, the ones living right now, have gone through generational education on hating the Jews. That's a big part of it. You can't change it just like that in one day. But also with the Israelis, imagine the amount of patience and the amount of trust you would have to have. They've been living with the London terror attacks for 50 years. Basically, that happening almost every day in their country. So all of a sudden, you're said, oh, you have to trust the people who have been trying to kill you. Mm-hmm. You have to let your children go to school with them. They're your bus driver now. I mean, that's crazy. No other population on earth would ever be had to make that choice. And so a lot of Israelis want peace, but the normal people, how do you bridge that gap without having some kind of meaningful change in the other side, in the Palestinians? And that's, politicians can say what they want, but if there isn't change with the people, all of the people, especially the Palestinians, then there never will be peace.
Yeah, and that when we're looking at a problem like terrorism, where you're looking at a problem in like the Middle East conflict, it's almost like, I don't know if people really believe this, but it's kind of the idea that's put out there that 99% of people are good, but there's just that, oh, that really nasty 1%, and we don't really know where they are or where they're hiding, but they're the ones that cause all the trouble. But most people aren't like that, when that's absolutely ridiculous. It is mostly the entire population that have one has a conflict with the other. It's not, and that's sort of the same narrative with terrorism. Like, well, 99% of people are fine. There's just that one little bad group in there. No, it permeates throughout the whole population.
What about the whole neighborhoods that harbor terrorists for months and know what their attack is about to be, and they don't stop it because they are more loyal to those terrorists than they are to their nation?
Yeah, exactly. It is a unique problem because in America, when we look back on World War II, we don't say, well, just the soldiers fighting Nazi Germany or just the Nazi soldiers were bad. Well, some people say that. Just the Nazi soldiers were bad. The German people are faultless on what happened during the Holocaust. That's impossible. And I'm not indicting a whole generation of Germans, but they're the ones who allowed Hitler to come to power, and there is a sizable amount of them who did support it in one way or the other, or at least were complicit with it, or complacent, or whatever you might say. But we don't look at the same way as we would treat the Palestinians, to where it's not the Palestinians' fault that they're in the situation they're in. It's the fault of the terrorist groups and the other Arab leaders who force this upon them and are just using them as a pawn in a huge war. And with the terrorism, it's to fight a war, you have to pinpoint who the enemy is. And if you can't do that, then it's impossible. But what happens when the enemies are from a certain ethnic group or a certain religion, but they're not from a nation? How do you pinpoint the problem? And that's kind of we're just getting caught in political correctness trying to fix what's going on.
Yeah, plays into the terrorist hands for sure, different groups like that. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. One of our listeners sent in a message and said they'd rather watch Kyrie Irving than LeBron James. So we'll end on that note. That's all the time we have for today. Trumpet Radio Live, myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Church, and Abraham Blondeau. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.